Thank you. Marshall, could you call our the court into session, please?
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman, Judge Ross, Judge Larkin, the Honorable Louise Dovre Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Tuesday, March 12th, 2024. We have three matters on our calendar for oral argument this morning. The first is State of Minnesota versus Peter Joseph Nyquanabi. As you know, we are proceeding by Zoom this morning, but the same rules will apply to the course of this oral argument. You will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your arguments, because we will be making an audio recording of this. That is the only recording that is authorized of this Zoom session. So with that, counsel for appellant, Mr. Sailors, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Christopher Sailors, and I'm the counsel for Peter Nyquanabi, who is the appellate to this case, if I may please the court. Thank you. Cases that are decided on razor-thin edges, as far as credibility is concerned, with no corroborated evidence, the need for misconduct or the overwhelming misconduct has an outsized impact on how the case is decided. This case was decided on an unfair premise that Mr. Nyquanabi had everything to lose: his job, his career, his reputation, the ability to feed his family if he lost this case, giving him permission to essentially tell every lie he needs to tell in order for this case to be decided in his favor. There's nothing he wouldn't do to essentially win this case. That was the implication that was made. That's how the state ended their cross-examination with Mr. Nyquanabi. They submitted a motion in limine, which said that they are not allowed to talk about the job, or I was not allowed to talk about any impact on his job, anything that would happen in both the case and closing argument. This happened in trial while Mr. Nyquanabi was testifying by the state's own attorney. They acknowledged the mistake they made in this case to say, well, if you lose this case, won't you lose your job? To which he said, yes, I
but
will lose.
Mr. Sailors, isn't that, I mean, that kind of is always out there in a case. And as I read the transcript, your client testified in direct examination about his position with the Mille Lacs Band and the number of people he supervised and things like that. So I'm having a hard time understanding what sort of prejudice is occasioned by the cross-examination, even if we consider that it was clear error in proceeding that line of cross-examination.
It's commonplace for every person who testifies to tell the jury what they do for their job at that point. It's a very common thing. Where do you live? What do you do? And then you essentially move on. You just essentially say this.
That may be so, but in this case, it seemed as if there was sort of a suggestion of great value to his job, that it was sort of a sense of importance, lending credibility to his testimony. In the way he didn't just say, this is my job. I think he indicated how many individuals he oversees. I'm not exactly sure what the testimony was, but something along those lines.
Well, because someone is charged with a crime and because they're in a position of supervision versus someone who's not in a position of supervision, it's just what he does. It's a factual term. He's someone that this is what his job is. That's the person that's fined.
There was the opportunity for a curative instruction, and I think some instruction was given over your client's request. But yet, there was something I think told to the jury to mitigate any potential prejudice. Am I correct about that? And if I'm correct, how does that play into the issue of prejudice?
Well, because again, this is a he said, she said case. And essentially, if someone has nothing to lose versus the alleged victim in this case, she had nothing to gain, nothing to lose, which we believe is misconduct at that point, because it shifts the burden for us to essentially answer the question, which we did prior to the case coming in. And I know maybe that's not your direct question, but we did have evidence as to why she was potentially fabricating. Versus that was not allowed to come in versus his job and the curative instruction, which is what your question was. And that is that once the cat's out of the bag, curative instructions are wonderful. I think they help, but at the same time, once the jury hears something, they can't unhear it. And then when they hear it repeatedly in closing argument,
the he said, she said conflict here that the jury had to deal with. Now, it is generally the case, if you, as you've acknowledged in your brief, that the testimony of even one credible witness is enough, except, and you point this out, when that testimony is questionable, and in that circumstance, you need some corroboration. I've got two questions for you. One is with regard to the questionableness of the complainant's testimony. What do you see as to the basis for substantially questioning the credibility of the allegations here?
Oh, there's the litany of matters. I mean, anything from how much she was drinking to her timeline to what was happening to how long this happened to what she had said when he left the car, please don't tell my girlfriend. And then she changed that later to please don't tell my wife. I mean, the transcript of the cross-examination was littered with a litany of examples where she contradicted herself, prior inconsistent statements, things that just weren't believable, timelines that weren't believable, situations that just, she said that she had sent a text message. Yes.
Oh, no, go ahead. I mean, there are always going to be some inconsistencies, we assume, in testimony. And none of the things you mentioned seem to be great inconsistencies. I mean, just the fact that he said, don't tell my girlfriend, my wife. I was looking to see whether there's any corroboration, even assuming that there's some lack of some reason to question the complainant's allegations or testimony. I mean, you've got the Gino's surveillance camera, which indicates the time that he leaves. And she says that she made a call immediately after they parted company, which puts it about 15 minutes later. But the house is only approximately, I think, 3 minutes was the testimony, three blocks away from the bar. So, I mean, 15 minutes elapsed from the time they left the bar until she made that call. I noticed when police showed up at his house, and the jurors saw the body cam footage when your client was asked whether they had stopped. And his response was equivocal. Well, I don't think, you know, he didn't think he stopped, he said. Then he said, I don't know whether they stopped on the way home or not. I don't remember. But then when he was told that there was some accusation of impropriety, he said, no, I didn't do anything. But yet he said he didn't remember whether they had stopped, but suddenly he knows. I mean, wouldn't the jurors be concerned that your client's testimony appeared to be lacking in credibility when he acknowledged that he didn't know what had happened, but then declared unequivocally that he couldn't have done anything?
I don't know what the jurors were thinking. I never got a chance to pull them and talk to them after the thing. I think what your honor is suggesting could be a plausible explanation, but I also think it could be a plausible explanation that they thought he was lying to protect his career at this point, which was mentioned over and over again throughout the trial. So I can't get inside the head of the jurors and anticipate that they thought this or thought that. I thought I was in the trial, and I thought that the victim's testimony, where the court says, well, these are little things, and there's going to be little things through every trial, every situations. I acknowledge that's true to an extent. However, when there is just at some point, the little things add up. The little things become a big thing when it's over and over and over again, when the nature of the story, just the major details just can't be right, and the timelines just can't be right. For instance,
you talk about the major details. I mean, as I look at the record, there are certainly inconsistencies. How much did you drink? How long were you gone? Well, it seemed like a half hour. Well, it might have seemed like a half hour, but it wasn't. And that was, you know, through vigorous cross-examination, that certainly came out. But in terms of the elements of the offense, it seems to me the testimony around those elements was consistent. And isn't that for the jury to decide? And why isn't her testimony sufficient to sustain the jury's determination?
Sure. The jury can decide that. The jury should decide that. The jury is in the best position to decide that, but that's assuming the jury has things that are fair. The jury doesn't get to hear impermissible arguments that this guy's only telling the truth and he has no credibility, because if he loses this case, if he wins the case, then he gets to keep his job, he gets to feed his family, he gets to keep his reputation. Everything of that implication is going to make him far less credible, and everything makes her more credible because why would she lie? Why would she go through this? Why would she do this at this point? When in reality, again, I mentioned this, but it bears repeating. We had a motion in limine that was denied by the court that said there was Facebook messages, there was a police report, there was witness testimony of this woman's boyfriend essentially trying to commit extortion against my client. Because again, I mean, I don't think it's a secret. He's a successful member of the Mille Lacs Band workforce. He's someone that does have some financial means. And there was an attempt after this whole thing was brought up to essentially get money out of my client. And we wanted to argue that to the jury, which the state knew we couldn't argue that. It's not like in the middle of closing argument, we can say, all right, they've opened the door to an impermissible argument. We're going to call a rebuttal witness in the middle of closing argument. They waited till the case was over, and then they started making the argument about what does she have to gain from this? It's an unfair argument that shifts the burden. And the sufficiency of the evidence, the determinations made, the credibility by the jury, all those things are fair for the jury to determine, but the jury needs fair rules. They did not have fair rules in this game. The victim, alleged victim in this case, was looked like she had nothing to gain. My client was looked like he had everything to lose. Those are unfair. If that was the way trials were to be structured, every case would be structured that way. Any case besides like a case where a husband and an ex-wife were testifying, there was a custody battle, and there was, you know, whatever happened in this case would determine the implication of the custody battle. Well, that would be a situation where something had someone to gain and someone had something to lose. Every trial, someone has something to lose. And what happens there in this particular situation is, why doesn't the state just get to say, well, don't believe them, they're going to go to jail if they lose. Don't believe them, they're going to go to prison for the rest of their lives. They can't say things like that because the jury can't determine decisions like that. The jury shouldn't determine that this individual is going to lose his job and his seven, he'd be able to take care of his seven kids. It cannot wrap my head around the fact that trials are not based on, this is why you need to believe our witness. Here's why, A, B, and C. She testified credibly. Yes, she got some details wrong, but did you see her body language? Did you see the way she answered the questions? Did you see how scared she was to be in the same room with that person? Those are fair arguments. That was not what's argued here. What's argued here in this case was a straw man argument that basically could be implied in any criminal defense case ever. And that is essentially that, what does she have to gain by being here? And he has everything to lose. Compare and contrasted that with who he was and his position and the acrimonious relationship between the Mille Lacs Band and the community and the citizens of Mille Lacs County. Since I've been working.
I understand what you're saying, but, you know, I sort of took the, what does she have to gain by this, as sort of a comment on her credibility in light of the significant attacks that were made against that credibility in vigorous cross-examination, in evidence about her lack of reputation for truthfulness. Why would we view the prosecutor's approach as anything other than, we're just trying to shore up the credibility of this witness, not really even comment about defendant's credibility?
Then talk about her credibility. Talk about why she's credible. Make an argument. Make an argument with the facts. Don't just make empty public policy arguments that could be made in every single case, that why is someone credible? Or what does she have to gain at this point? Again, we had evidence to show what she was potentially trying to do, and that was not allowed into evidence. So in my situation, Mr. Naquin Navy was fighting with his hands behind his back because he couldn't answer the state's rhetorical question about what does she have to gain. And I do think that shifts the burden. It challenges the defense to essentially say, well, if I can't explain what does she have to gain, which in this case, in a lot of cases, you can't. In a lot of cases, what you see is the state will argue, well, why are they lying? Why are they telling the truth? And the defense attorney is left in the impossible position to explain, well, you can't find my client not guilty if I can't explain to you why this person is lying. And that's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That's not presumption of innocence. It shifts the burden to the defense to say, well, here's why she's lying. And she's lying this because they have this secret lawsuit going on that where she's suing him. And if she wins this case, she's going to get X amount of money.
When we consider prejudice, we obviously consider the evidence and whether there's already evidence that bears on the allegation or the consequence of the allegedly prejudicial conduct. In this case, credibility is really what we're talking about as the prejudice. But as I look at the testimony, I see the jurors saw him respond to police asking him, well, did she take you anywhere else besides straight home? And he said, well, I don't think so. You know, really, I don't know. I don't remember. And then later denying that anything at all occurred, being told that there's an allegation of impropriety, but never specifically asking, well, what exactly am I accused of? I mean, I would think that a juror would be concerned about your client's credibility immediately when he's confronted with an accusation, and he never inquires, what exactly am I accused of having done? He just doesn't say anything, but he acknowledges that there was this drive to his house and it took 15 minutes to get there. That seems to be significant. Explain to me why it's not so, as it goes to credibility.
Could I ask you a question, Your Honor?
Feel free to.
Are you
not usually the case, but go ahead.
Are you saying that because you got that argument from closing argument, or are you saying that because you got that argument from your reading of the transcript?
Oh, I'm looking at what the jurors would have seen.
Right.
And since we can't get into the juror's head, it's like, right, what would a reasonable juror think about? Because it's all about credibility, I'm assuming that a reasonable juror is going to be watching that statement and trying to put the pieces together as to who's telling the truth, and concerned, right, about the client's some complete lack of knowledge as to whether he even stopped somewhere, which seemed doubtful. He was so sure there wasn't any impropriety, so he did have a memory of what happened, but he had no memory that they went somewhere other than his house.
And the reason I ask is because that wasn't in closing argument. That's a good argument. That's a good argument that a state prosecutor could make, and the defense attorney could respond to that argument. I could say, well, this is why he was thinking this, or this is why he was thinking this. This is done in the Court of Appeals long after the case is over, long after direct cross-examination, closing arguments, rebuttal, everything and the like. So it's an argument by Your Honor at this point, but it was not in the record at this time. So,
well, it's a question, not an argument.
But. Sure, I get the distinction. And so that is, it belies my point of, we weren't playing with fair rules here, where we're responding to questions, we're responding to arguments, we're responding to things about the facts, we're responding to things that shouldn't be talked about in this case. This case was about things that shouldn't be talked about.
I'm going to stop you right there, Mr. Saylors, just because your time has expired and you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal to follow up on this line of inquiry or anything else. We'll turn now to the argument from Respondents' Counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Erica Mador. I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. Your Honors, there are three issues that defense raised that we need to address today: the sufficiency of the evidence, the objected to claims of prosecutorial error, and the unobjected to claims of prosecutorial error. Looking first at sufficiency of the evidence, the question, of course, is whether a reasonable jury could convict appellant of fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct. In this case, there's no dispute that the victim's testimony meets those elements if she is credible. If the jury believes her version of events, all of the elements have been satisfied. What appellant is essentially arguing is that her version of events is inherently incredible. And I would point the court to three key
facts. I don't
think
that's the argument. I think his argument is that it's a thin distinction between her credibility and his credibility. It comes down to a credibility battle, and because
yes, that is what he just argued for. Your Honor, I would direct the court to three key facts that support sufficiency of the evidence in this case. The victim's version of events was against her own interests. She admitted to the court and to law enforcement that she was underage drinking while on the job, and driving after she had been drinking with a passenger in the vehicle. I would also point the court to the fact that she remained generally consistent, again, on those major details, over 50 pages of cross-examination. And there was evidence admitted through appellant's witnesses, an attempted alibi that was discredited. So
I'd
in
like
light
you to focus before, if you don't mind, I mean, yes. You can argue however you like, but it would be helpful to me if first you address the what the state admits was an error, prejudicial, or an error in the prosecution of the case by emphasizing a fact that the district court said you weren't allowed to emphasize.
Yes, absolutely. I can address that. Your Honor, there are three reasons why, although this was indeed an error, it was a mistake and a misreading of the motion in limine, it is harmless error in this case. The objection was untimely and it specifically refused any remedy. Your Honor had asked about a curative instruction. On pages 14 to 16 of my brief, I have the excerpt from the transcript where this on the record discussion was had with the court. Defense counsel came back and specifically stated, I'm not going to move for a mistrial. I don't want a curative instruction. I plan to address it. There was further discussion by the court about the standard jury instruction about not considering possible penalties as being curative to a jury because they don't routinely receive that instruction for their purposes.
Well, bear in mind, I mean, it's certainly not implausible, and it's not bad strategy. It's often very good strategy for an attorney representing a defendant who is facing inappropriate evidence, not to want that evidence emphasized with a curative instruction that just, you know, the judge says, all right, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, there was an elephant in the room, and I just want you to know that you shouldn't pay any attention to the elephant in the room. Don't look at the elephant in the room. Don't even think about the elephant in the room or the pink spots on the elephant. We get curative instructions all the time, but we often say on appeal that, well, we trust the jurors to rely upon curative instructions and they obey what the judge says, but we all know that when something's in your head, it's hard to get it out. So I don't know that your curative instruction argument resolves the question of prejudice.
Right. And Your Honor, in this particular case, in fact, that error was amplified because counsel chose to adopt it and turn it tactically to his own purposes. So instead of it being an elephant in the room that was mentioned once and then attempted to cover up, in fact, appellant was the one who repeated it again and again and again. When he talks about multiple mentions, it was his multiple mention. It comes up in redirect and it comes up in closing argument. There's actually lines in my brief again, pulling from the transcript of closing argument. Appellant praised the state for making that error because it opened the door. He specifically stated, I'm glad the state talked about a couple of things. I'm glad they talked about his job. It shows you that these allegations, when they're untrue, they affect a career. So he took that error and he ran with it.
There's a difference between taking an error and running with it and taking an error and doing the best you can with it by attempting to show the jury that, well, this doesn't harm us at all. The lawyer might be very well aware that it harms his client and didn't want it in the case, or there wouldn't have been a motion in limine to start with. So I appreciate the argument. It might be from the juror's perspective that, well, the defendant was okay with this. I'm not sure that a lawyer saying that he's okay with this evidence coming in, telling the jurors that, means that in fact he was okay with the evidence coming in or that there's no prejudice. I'm guessing you have a stronger prejudice argument that you'd like to make.
And I would just ask again, or state again, that there was no objection in this case. When that line of questioning was started, again, it was an error, but there was no objection from the defense. Instead, they waited for the entirety of the cross-examination to close. They went up, they rehabilitated on that point. Two witnesses later is
when you say there was no objection, I mean, there was a motion in limine.
Right.
And there was a decision on that motion. So you're not suggesting that it was waived, are you?
I'm suggesting that if counsel felt strongly about it and felt that it was an important issue that really did undermine their ability to successfully defend this case, it should have been first and foremost in their mind. And that should have been something that immediately set off a red flag and raised an objection.
So how does that affect our prejudice analysis? Why would that factor in? I've never known of a case that says, well, there was no objection, therefore there must not have been prejudice.
Because again, Your Honor, it's not possible to separate at this point what the state did versus what the defense did when they took the error and they ran with it. And they made it, they flipped it essentially in support of his credibility. And they talked about how there is a significant effect here, but he's not concerned about it. He's a well-educated man. He's someone that doesn't have any concerns about his ability to get a new job.
That's not what he told the court. That's what he told the jury.
Correct.
You don't see the distinction?
I'm afraid I don't. Your Honor, if I may address some other errors as well, some other arguments. There is also what I wanted to raise in this case. There was some discussion during counsel's argument about evidence being excluded during a motion in limine about the defendant or the appellant having financial means. And he says it's not a secret that Mr. Nkwanebi has financial means. It actually was to the victim. That's why this evidence was excluded in this case. When you go back to the transcript right at the start and you look at the motions in limine that are argued, the district court made a finding that the evidence offered by appellant actually failed 401. The issue wasn't whether in this case, it wasn't one where that extortion theory was plausible, because at the time that the victim made her statement to law enforcement saying somebody touched me sexually, she did not know who Mr. Nkwanebi was. She was not a member of that community. She was not a member of the band. When she learned his name, there was absolutely no recognition in her eyes about who he was or the fact that he was someone of influence. That evidence didn't come out until several weeks later. After that had been disclosed to her, she shared it with her family. At that point, her boyfriend goes out and makes what is admittedly an improper comment to the Nkwanebis. But at the time that all of this evidence was gathered and this investigation was begun, she had no idea who he was. She knew his first name and the color of his hair and his shirt, and that was basically it. So that's why that evidence was excluded. It was not improper for us then to argue that on closing, that she had no motive to lie about this. She's not a member of the community.
I think the issue is her motive. I think the argument is it was improper to argue about his motive. I believe and why does the state get to emphasize that? I mean, in addition to the introducing the evidence, there was the piling on during closing argument. Do you dispute that that occurred?
The state did not pile on during closing argument. I would not agree with that, no. We talked about
by emphasizing that his employment made him.
No, we did not do that. We had received the instruction from the judge not to reference employment. That did not enter into the closing argument.
But by inference, I mean the emphasis on the fact that the victim had nothing to gain, even though, of course, that evidence isn't, you know, there isn't evidence particularly in the record about that. I mean, isn't that by implication saying that the defendant, or arguing to the jury, suggesting to the jury that the defendant in fact did have everything to gain by lying?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because again, the burden is always on the state. And we talked about that during our closing argument as well. The burden is on us to show that this victim is credible and that she's someone who should be believed. And when she has to take that first affirmative step and participate not only in the law enforcement investigation, but then appearing again at trial, when she goes through that process and she starts to shut down during cross-examination, that puts us in a position of having to rehabilitate her and talk about why someone might do that during our closing. So
I feel like there's a distinction not being recognized in your argument between emphasizing the credibility of the state's witness, the complainant, and challenging the credibility of the accused. Do you not see a distinction between those two?
There was a distinction, Your Honor, but I don't feel that we truly made it. We didn't go on at length about that.
You're arguing about how necessary and proper it was for the state to emphasize the complainant's credibility. But the argument, I think, on appeal was the improper argument, evidence, and implication about the defendant's credibility. Aren't those distinct?
Those are distinct, yes.
So maybe you can respond to Judge Bjorkman's question from that perspective, as opposed to supporting your client or supporting the complainant.
Your Honor, I don't feel that I have the record to make a distinction on that. The argument that we presented at closing was talking primarily first and foremost about this victim. If there was an inference in the negative against Mr. Nkwanebi that because this victim is here going through something that is traumatic and that she does not want to do, and Mr. Nkwanebi is here, I guess I don't see that we went down that line of questioning. I'm having difficulty with it even now on the spot. Looking then to the remaining arguments that had been raised in this case, I do just want to talk as well about the assertion about disparaging the defense. I would point the court to State versus Melanson, which was cited in my brief, affirming conviction in kind of along the lines of what we were just discussing. In closing argument in Melanson, where the state had called cross-examination an attack on the victim and made criticisms about the demeanor that opposing counsel and the appellant had had during the course of the trial, because it was not at risk of misleading the jury, disparaging the defense's trial strategy, or mischaracterizing appellant's motives for going to trial, that was not considered error. It was instead viewed as an attempt to address inconsistencies and weaknesses in the state's case. And that, I would say, is the same situation that happened here. Again, we had a witness who conceded certain points during cross-examination because she was frustrated, embarrassed, or confused. Even if the court finds that a reference about defense counsel's demeanor or about, in this case, the actions of appellant during the course of trial, we'd argue that it's harmless error. It's not responsible for the verdict. It was a single line in rebuttal that was not repeated after the objection. And again, the jury saw the cross-examination take place. They could decide for themselves if that was an accurate interpretation of counsel's actions. I believe then, I've addressed everything that I wanted to. Just on the why would she lie? There was a question that appellant had raised in his brief about whether that was analogous to the were they lying questions that are generally considered prohibited. I cited to Genchi Ramirez, which quite clearly set forth they are not analogous. They are not equivalent to each other. Why would she lie specifically was found not to be an improper line of questioning. It was something that when we had a victim who, in that case, had put herself through the sexual assault examination process, had gone through all of the rigmarole attendant to participating in the investigation and the trial, that was not considered error. It was not wrong for the prosecutor to raise that specific rhetorical question. So I would point the court in that direction as well. Your Honors, I have about a minute left. If the court has no further questions, I would just ask that appellant's conviction be affirmed.
I see no further questions. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Sailors, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. It was mentioned that they did pile on in their closing argument. I just want to read something from the transcript. This was on the second transcript, pages 158 through 159. I found it interesting that our life was at stake, was what Mr. Naquanabi told you. That if he's convicted of this allegation, his integrity is at stake. It's a small community in Namia, not a lot of people. They've lived here for 9 years. They've put down roots. His reputation is absolutely at risk if he's convicted of this. He has a lot to lose. So if that isn't piling on, I don't know what the definition of piling on is. To sit there and say that a defendant has a lot to lose, his reputation, his standing in the community, by implication, his job, his children, things along that nature, that's the definition of piling on. And the state has amnesia, apparently, when it comes to that quote in the which was in my brief about that allegation. And I think that's just underscores, again, the unfair playing field that we had in this case, that they continue to insist that they did nothing wrong in this case because of the policy arguments that they're making, simply making that because someone has a job, it's a successful job, and he has the ability to potentially lose that job if he gets convicted. That's why you can't believe anything that's out of his mouth. Instead of talking about the facts, like we've done more in this argument than we did in the actual trial, we talk about these holistic public policy arguments that are pertainable to any particular trial. There are things in this thing about when the court talked about vigorous cross-examination, state referred to that as snapping in her face. So here's this person, this poor person who's coming back from Wisconsin, who has nothing to gain except this potential extortion stuff that came out later, who got her face snapped at by the defense attorney, who is going against someone who's not, and she's not a member of the band. And I think it is important to talk about the relationship between the county and the Mille Lacs band. Since I've been working in this area, there's been three lawsuits. Some of those lawsuits have gone all the way up to the United States Supreme Court, as far as hunting and fishing rights, boundary distinctions, and whether or not tribal government even has sovereignty to essentially have their own police force. This was all going on right around the time when these allegations came to light. Mr. Naquanabi works in that tribal government, the same tribal government that the county is suing. So to say the implications that she's not in this band, but by contrast, Mr. Naquanabi's in this band, what that does is it interjects his race and member of the Mille Lacs Band into a case, again, where credibility is on a razor's edge in this case. We're talking about things to lose. We're talking about implications of race. We're talking about his career, his reputation, and how she has nothing to do compared and contrasted with Mr. Naquanabi, nothing to gain, excuse me. So I just think that I would love to talk about the facts. I would love to have a discussion about why the state believed Mr. Naquanabi's statement wasn't credible and how I could argue against that, how I could respond to that in a rebuttal. But my rebuttal was reserved to having to explain to the jury that, yes, let's talk about how he has a lot to lose. Let's talk about the implications of this case. And let's talk about if someone is lying, what this could do to someone. Things that we shouldn't be talking about in criminal arguments. There's a reason why we keep these things from a jury, because it's just too emotional, it's too fraught, and we don't know how the jury's going to actually take it. We did not get inside and debrief this jury. I haven't heard what they were thinking about how they decided this case. For all I know, they could have easily decided it because the acrimonious relationship between the county and the Mille Lacs Band, here's this high-ranking member of the Mille Lacs Band, here he is, he's going to lose everything. If he loses this, clearly he's lying. That was the bulk of the state's argument, and she has nothing to gain. It wasn't, well, this is why you need to believe her. This is why you need to disbelieve him. That's how trials should be fought. They should be fought on the facts, not on policy. And that's what this case was. And it was policy that was agreed to. The rules of the game were agreed to. The rules of the trial were agreed to ahead of time. Those rules were violated by the state, and they continue to be violated by the state by implication in closing argument and rebuttal. It's just not fair to be able to say that she has nothing to gain in her closing argument once the trial's over and we can't call a rebuttal witness in this case. Mr. Naquanabi was fighting this trial with his hands behind his back. The rules were agreed to. They were broken by the state, and they doubled down on that breaking of the rules. So I cannot emphasize enough why I feel that this was unfair and why I feel that trials should be fought on the facts, not on rhetorical questions about why someone's lying or what someone has to lose.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your helpful arguments today. We appreciate them, and we will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. Thank you.
Thank you.